You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
It's kind of a harrowing story. I mean, I think for anything that kind of is in like the cloud of like mental illness or anything which is outside, like it's so hard to identify with that unless you've been through it. And I've seen so many guys that I've played with who have, you know, since, you know, dealt with so many different things that I was like, man, this is pretty interesting story, just for the fact that like trying to play in the NFL and manage all of that and manage what you had going on feels insurmountable.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those things, just trying to keep my head on straight and trying to figure out what's going on. You know, there's this chaos going all around, especially during the season. So just trying to figure out what all was going on. But, you know, we got it figured out eventually. So that's what we could ask for.
Was there ever a point where you thought everybody else is crazy, I'm not crazy, this is totally normal? Or you thought like, oh man, something's up?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like one of those things, like it just felt very isolating. And, you know, obviously I don't want to talk about like a lot of those things, the people, you know, like the things that are going on inside my head. Like, you know, initially it just kind of started out with a lot of like guilt and depression, anxiety. Like I'd wake up in the morning and my heartbeat was going a million miles an hour. And it's just like, it was just that mental gymnastics in my mind at that point where it's like, if I can just start my day off right, which I didn't know how to manage my mind, manage my thoughts at that time. And, you know, one thought would come to my head, it'd become a million different thoughts. And then, yeah, it just got to that point where it's like, you know, I was trying to talk to someone about it, but they weren't quite understanding why I wasn't able to grasp the concept of a lot of things that they were trying to tell me. Because at the time, you know, a lot of people that I was going to were, you know, people in the religious setting, you know, people of faith, and, you know, they just say, pray about it more. And it's like, you know, I think on my end that there's something wrong with me, you know, spiritually, but at the same time, it's like, and it, talking to someone that doesn't have OCD, they don't get it. And it's hard to make people understand. It's like stepping in someone's shoes. Like you really don't know what it's going to be like until you've actually gone through it. Like people that I've talked to that actually have OCD, they get in, you know, ever since that article came out, like, you know, there's a lot of people that are kind of like, you know, I've had the same thing. I just never knew that there was a name for this type of thing. Because OCD, there's like different categories of mine just happen to fall into the religious part of it. But yeah, there's definitely a time where I was just like, I'm the only one going through this. Why doesn't anyone else seem like they're going through this? And, you know, it kind of creates that anger and that frustration. And also just like the, damn, like, what am I going to do about this?
OCD is definitely an element. I can't speak on other professional sports just within the NFL. And I know for me, at least, I had to be very conscious of not spinning out on like the OCD side, you know, just for the fact that like you get into these little patterns and you get into these rituals, like how I got dressed on game day, the music I would listen to, what I would eat, you know, and you kind of like start modeling this stuff like, hey, I played really well. I did these things. Let me see if I can do these exact same things again and try to mimic it. And I found myself getting into a little bit of OCD where like, I mean, to the point where I would dress like the right side of my body and then the left. And then like, if I didn't play well, I would like, you know, think like, oh man, last time I put my right shoe on, I put my left shoe on. And then sitting back and being like, whoa, 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 this is spinning out. You're fucking crazy. And then talking to other people and seeing like other people's little rituals and patterns and realizing that like a lot of professional sports lends claim to that. And I don't know if it's mental illness or just that. By following a pattern, it's one less thing to worry about. And that's how I kind of couched it. So, you know, trying to, a big thing I always try to do on this podcast is a little bit of like empathy and trying to like understand, you know, like what this individual is going through. So trying to like think about, you know, down to uniforms, I would not play in a game in something I hadn't practiced in. So like whatever I practiced in, like, for example, like whether it be a t-shirt in this and I didn't change my deal, whether it was 105 degrees or if it was negative 40 degrees. And like if I changed one little thing, I would like, man, is that going to be the difference between playing well and not playing well? Which sounds batshit crazy until you talk to other NFL players and like, oh, that totally makes sense.
Yeah, I definitely had that. And, you know, that's kind of like the stage because I've had OCD for a while and, you know, kind of looking back on a lot of things, like there was definitely a lot of themes that I didn't notice at the time because it was like a short period of time. Like maybe I had like this theme that I was worried about for a month, but you know, I've always had the definitely like, you know, doing things a certain type of way, wearing certain types of things, tying my shoes amount a certain amount of times. But this year it kind of, obviously like it started into the theme of religion, you know, like, if I tape my fingers a certain amount of times or if I taped it the wrong way, then my mind told me that if I didn't redo it, then I was going to burn in hell.
Oh.
Yeah, it got pretty extreme. Like, there'd be times on the field, like, I think I've talked about this before, but it'd be like a two-minute drill. My mind would be like, you can win this game. You can play this perfect game and, you know, not give up a sack, not give up a pressure, be flawless, but you got to sell your soul to the devil. Those would be the things that kind of creep in into my mind. But yeah, everything religion-based, like,
oh my God,
I think it was a constant battle of not going to hell, not offending God, not serving the devil, that type of stuff.
And And then like the NFL is a weird landscape, and I've tried to explain this to people and I don't think they understand it unless you've been through it, where there's a lot of like, let me see, I couch this and that's not like a complete fucking asshole, but I've always believed just be authentic, be who you want to be. Like I'm not a big fan of deception. And like if you're a scumbag and you want to do and like run the streets and do all that crazy shit, like go do it. But like, don't pretend, like don't show up to Bible study walking around with a bunch of religious tattoos and a big, you know, $1 million, you know, diamond cross around your neck and all of a sudden start preaching scripture and whatnot. And yet, you know, all of a sudden you get arrested in the strip club or with like prostitutes or something. So like that was always really weird for me, especially in the NFL, was a lot of guys put up this veneer of like who they wanted to be and then live this like kind of dark existence on the backside. And I was like, dude, that to me was a lot worse than people that were like, hey, I'm going to go out and drink. I'm going to go out and do all these, you know, just basically be a piece of shit. And I would much rather deal with those people than the people that were the deception. And I felt like, because in situations where you went to go play in the game, like if they weren't honest with themselves as who they were, like how can you really trust them to play and do the job that you needed them to do? So that was kind of like where I extended that. And I can only imagine, you know, being around those individuals and you're probably like, oh my God, if we win this game and these guys suck. I mean, like it feels like an endless pit. Like you just start spiraling out and not knowing how to recover from it.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to FieldStrong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/FieldStrong
and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, with my OCD, obviously, it kind of, honestly, it turned me into, I was so deep into the rabbit hole that I couldn't see myself for what I was kind of becoming. You know, I was really the opposite of what, you know, faith really preaches, and, you know, becoming very judgmental of others. And, you know, it's kind of left me with a little bit of like resentment of everything that happened last year. Obviously, like, you know, I've talked about kind of about before, you know, I have God over here, and then I have my OCD God. You know, essentially last year I was worshiping the OCD God, because this version was basically the worst version of God you could possibly think of. Like, you know, it's kind of like the old school teachers, like, smacking a ruler against their hand, you know, basically like saying, you mess up. Like,
so Old Testament God versus New Testament God.
Only worse, because there was no room for error. Like, one bad thought pops in your mind, like, I had to correct it. Like, and that's where, like, the kind of the compulsions came in. But, you know, I was just, you know, you talk about kind of like the people around me, but honestly, I didn't even notice the people around me, because I was so in my own head. Like, I was just kind of a shell. And I kind of talk about it being like the sunken place in my own head, kind of like in the movie Get Out, where I'm really not even there. Like, something else is there, kind of just driving me on autopilot. Like, I was completely separate from the game. Like, I had no desire to play last year. I had no desire to have any type of relationship with people, because I was living this false reality, all these false perceptions in my head that, you know, I was just essentially just a zombie walking around. Wow. You know, constantly fighting for my survival every second of my day. Like, if I mess up, then I'm going to hell. And, you know, my mind took that every which direction you could possibly think of. And it was just overwhelming. And it's just like, it's kind of like one of those places where I got to the point where it was like, I don't really want to be alive, but I also don't want to die. So it's kind of like that. It was almost kind of like a prison for me. Like, there was no good side. There was no good alternative. And it was just miserable until, you know, I was actually able to break past that wall. And, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit later. But, yeah, it was long. Just not even, because I just had a newborn son that year too. And I didn't really even get to enjoy those months. And that really sucked. You know, I have a really loving wife. Didn't get to enjoy her, you know. It was just, yeah, I was living in my own prison inside my head. Essentially, I did go to hell because I was living in hell inside my own.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. Did you grow up religious? I mean, did you grow up in the church, or were you Catholic, born again, Protestant, any of that?
I wouldn't say. I was probably the checking the boxes Christian, you know, show up to church, I'm good with God. Living by works. I didn't take my faith very seriously until last year, which is when I, you know, as an athlete, you know, when you set your mind to something, like, you're going all in. You know, I went all in on my faith, and, you know, I'm searching, like, trying to find my way as a man of faith. And that was really difficult for me, because I didn't know the correct route to go. And, you know, that's kind of like the journey of life. Like, you kind of have to step in some different areas in order to find your way. And that was kind of difficult for me, because I was looking for assurance, looking for the right way. And everyone has a different way. That's why there's so many different denominations. And the thing about faith is there's no definite answer. And my OCD was always looking for that definite answer. Like, do I get the thumbs up? Am I good? Like, am I doing something right? Am I doing something wrong? And one of the worst things I possibly did was, you know, going online, you know, going to a Reddit page, like looking for answers.
Yeah, don't do that.
I could find all the right answers, and I'd find this one dude to just send me down this terrible like rabbit hole, and it was not good.
I want to pivot for a little bit. Like, how did like football first come in the picture? Like, growing up for you, like, where'd you grow up? How did football first kind of come into focus, and then, you know, obviously get to the position you're at?
Yeah. So I started playing flag football, I think second or third grade, and then fourth grade. That's when I started playing tackle football. But, you know, I just really had like a love of the game. You know, I just like the aggression side, the competitive part, you know, just, you know, a boy just got all this energy, you know, just want to go bash some heads in and stuff like that. And that was really just kind of the appealing part. Like, there is no really limit to it. I mean, my dad played football in college, so I kind of got raised up in it a little bit, but always been something I've been very passionate about. And, you know, just that competitive nature of football has always been appealing to me.
Did you have any like early mentors or like early experiences that kind of shaped the mindset and like kind of set that work ethic? Because, you know, obviously it's a long journey, and I don't think people necessarily understand how long the journey takes, especially when you get to the NFL. Like, for me, I didn't start playing football until I got to high school, and then, you know, obviously college, and then, you know, you go on to get drafted, and then next thing you know, you know, play a bunch of years in the NFL. But I wonder if like there was any pivotal moments that kind of shaped that early on.
Yeah, I definitely think like my dad was the one that really kind of shaped my work ethic. I mean, he introduced me to like working out when I was 10 years old. He never forced me to ever work out, but it was just something like, you know, I wanted to get stronger, and, you know, that was the way to do it. And, you know, he just kind of like showed me the right way to work, you know, working out. And, you know, I just kind of eventually just took that under my own responsibility and started doing that myself. And, you know, started going down like 4 or 5 days a week into my basement and just like working out, and I loved it. But yeah, my dad has always been like my mentor and teaching me how to, you know, work, you know, have my work ethic, and, you know, show me what it took to become successful. And I wouldn't be here without what he taught me, because he taught me from a very young age, like, you know, you can be with the crowd, you can do what everyone else is doing, but you're not going to get to where you want to be.
So then, obviously, you get drafted, come in the NFL, and you started as a rookie.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I started week 5, so it was like a Thursday night game. You know, it took 3 right tackles to go down for me to be able to get my first start. And I was drafted as a guard. I was practicing at guard pretty much the entirety of the time, and I played a little bit of tackle during camp, but yeah, I was just kind of like, all right, you know, New England Patriots are, we're going to New England, get some walkthrough reps and you'll be good. I don't know if anyone knew that I was going to have any type of success or not, but it's kind of like, you know, we started out the season like 1-5. So it's not like we were making any big runs at the time. So I guess it was like, see what happens, and, you know, start that night, and, you know, year 8, you know, I'm still the right tackle. So, I mean, I've been blessed and fortunate enough to have the success I've had. And a lot of people have brought me up along the way.
Yeah. Any major injuries or anything that you've dealt with?
I dealt with some really bad patellar tendonitis my 6th year. And it was partially torn about halfway through the season. Like, it was just something that got really bad, progressively got worse. And, yeah, it just needed surgery at the end of the season to kind of clean it up. And, yeah, the knees have always been kind of, since year 5, kind of been a struggle. Just a lot of tendonitis in the patellas and in the quad tendons. And, you know, just something you got to do. You got to be able to bend, and was a struggle for me. I mean, I've torn my plantar fascia. My 4th year was out 6 weeks with that, but honestly, like, I've been very fortunate and haven't had really any major physical injuries. Just things that are just kind of nagging, and, you know, just got to play through them for the most part.
Yeah, my rookie year, I came in and started, and then I ruptured my patellar tendon. I mean, fucking complete rupture, and they stitched that thing back. And but yeah, I dealt with patellar tendonitis. It ends up coming on if I have like any kind of weakness or kind of anything's going on in my hamstrings. So like the hamstring doesn't stabilize, the knee tends to have a little bit of issue. So I know if like the tendonitis comes up, I do a bunch of glute stuff, and it seems to work pretty well in terms of getting rid of it.
Yeah, I definitely started for kind of focusing on that for the longest time. Like, you know, people are like, oh, you got to get your quad strong. Like, that'll help your So I'd be on the freaking leg extension machine and stuff like that. And, you know, last year when I started really kind of focusing on like the glutes and hamstrings, like I don't do any squats anymore or anything like that. Like, I'll get like single leg stuff, but putting on a bar on my back or anything like that, it's like a no-go for me. Plus, I had some back issues like my junior year in college, where, you know, I had the L4, L5 bulging disc and had a drop foot for about 3 or 4 months. And that was not fun to deal with. But luckily, that's gone away with some good core work, good stabilization stuff.
So as you, you know, I mean, obviously you're going into your eighth year. It's kind of interesting. Like, was there like a moment that kind of pivoted into this? I mean, like, it's such a fascinating tale to me. The fact that like, here you are almost 30 years old and, you know, have this NFL career and you go on and like, it was like, hey, you know what? I want to try to dial in more on my faith. And then this ends up kind of manifesting. And then, you know, obviously you kind of go through this last season. And then, I thought the fascinating one was the Ibogaine, because we've had a bunch of different, SEALs, you know, Doc Parsley, who's a good friend of mine here. He's a former SEAL, was a medical doc, and has taken a bunch of SEALs down to Mexico to do the Ibogaine, who were kind of like, this was their last hope. I mean, suicidal, drugs, the whole deal. And like the result from the Ibogaine has been pretty amazing. We had a guy on the podcast that was like, if this didn't work, it was basically a gun in my mouth. And I went down there and did this treatment, and it completely gave his whole life back.
Yeah, that was definitely kind of my posture with it. It was kind of the last ditch effort, because missed the last 5 games of the season last year because I went to a mental health facility in Colorado. Was there for 48 days, and I really didn't get too much out of it. I was marginally better. It gave me time to really kind of like slow down and kind of focus on what my true enemy was. Like, I had better awareness of what my OCD was. I could put it down on paper. Like, I could say like, oh, okay, this is OCD, these are the tendencies, but I was still having, there's still that block that I couldn't quite get through, like this block in my mind with it actually like resonating through my entire being. It's one thing to conceptualize, it's another thing to internalize and really believe something. And so I'll go to Tijuana, Mexico. It's a 5-day treatment. And my father-in-law is actually the one who found out about it. And then my wife was like, all right, like, this is something we should seriously consider. You know, I was kind of like thinking about it, like, oh, go to Mexico and do psychedelics. Like, you know, take the OCD into it. And I'm like imagining like this shack in like some random part of Mexico, you know, here at Tijuana. It's like, man, like, this could be really bad. Like, I'm not going to do that.
Like, you look over and see Aaron Rodgers in the next teepee.
Yeah, I was thinking even something worse, just because I heard some interesting stories while I was in rehab, too, about one dude got assaulted while he was, like, doing it. And I was like, oh, boy, like, you know, not this treatment, but he was doing something else in, like, Costa Rica or something like that. So I was like, man, like, I don't know. And the way he kind of described his experience was really kind of like literally just like a shack in the jungle or something like that. But actually, when I was in rehab, when I extended, I was only supposed to be there 30 days and I extended an extra 18. And when I extended, there was a veteran who actually started talking to me about Ibogaine, and he mentioned the place Ambio Life and told me that was the best place to go. And you know, we were looking into different places because, I mean, obviously, like, you don't know what the best place is because that stuff really, you know, it's overseas. It's not approved in the U.S. It's very much kind of taboo right now, and hopefully it won't be soon because, I mean, I got some really good benefits. Not benefits, even life-changing things happen from it. But But he told me about his experience and it. So the way they set up the treatment, you, like I said, 5 days, you go in the first day, you do like a sweat lodge. Second day, you do the Ibogaine. Then the third day is a gray day, which is kind of like your recovery day. And that day really sucks. But then the next day, after that fourth day, you do something called 5-MeO-DMT. Mm-hmm. And I think the Ibogaine and the 5-MeO work perfectly together for me. Because the Ibogaine, they say, is kind of like the refinement. It's basically that sledgehammer that breaks apart that, let's say you're like a puzzle that's been put together the wrong way. Like some kid has come and smashed the pieces together so they do fit. And that's kind of like how our brain's kind of like stuck together. It's put together the wrong way. You know, you think about people with addictions, people with PTSD, like people with OCD, like our brains are wired the wrong way. Like we got these pathways that are going to places they shouldn't, things that are on those neurons that shouldn't be there. Breaks that all apart, puts it back to the factory default. And for me, my experience on it wasn't very intense. In terms of like the guy I was talking about who introduced me to it, his experience. So he was an interrogator in the military and his experience was very intense, a 28-hour experience with some pretty bad stuff that he had to confront. But, and he was ready to like end it all after that experience. He's like, man, this is terrible. Like y'all did this to me. And then he does the 5-MeO a couple days later. And it really pieced everything together for him and really changed his life. Like when he talks about his story, like he cries like tears of joy every time. And it's pretty like amazing. You can see it in his eyes. Like it gave him his life back. And for me, the Ibogaine kind of did something similar. Like I didn't have a crazy experience, but it really does detox you physically, mentally, and spiritually. Like my left foot was like twitching the entire night. So something was going on there in my brain, but you can just feel like this chill go down through your spine, dry heaving all night. You know, there was some crazy stuff going on, but, and one of the side effects is your body goes ataxic. So the next day you wake up, you feel like you're a toddler learning to walk for the first time. Like that's how much it's kind of like rewiring everything in your brain, you know, kind of gives you that blank slate again. And thing about the Ibogaine, I think, is important for people to also know is that it's not a cure, but it gives you the ability to cure yourself, which is important because once you leave, you get probably about 3 months where you're just riding high, like above the clouds, like you feel great, you feel like you can conquer anything. And I think that can be dangerous for a lot of people because they think they're cured and they don't do anything. For me, like, luckily, like, I had a good plan set in place that, you know, I was, once I got out of it, you know, I was in the IOP for 2 weeks, 3 hours a day getting OCD therapy. Like, I was in it hard and, you know, it was something, it's kind of like the Ibogaine opened all those doors in my mind and it was up to me to explore them and, you know, create good habits. You know, use different tools that are given to me and apply everything that I can now actually internalize versus conceptualize. And kind of going back to the treatment, you know, after on the gray day, that was kind of one of those days that was really tough for me. I was like, I made a mistake coming here. And then the next day, I was worried about doing the 5-MeO-DMT because, again, you hear different stories about it, and usually it's from most of the bad stories are from people that use it in a very, not a very good setting, you know, just using it at a party or a street or something like that. And, you know, it's not a good setting for it. Using it recreationally is what I'm trying to say. But,
so you're not having parties, inviting people over for a little 5-MeO-DMT party, like Joe Rogan style?
No, it's crazy because one of my friends, he said he actually got some, like he's got vaporized in a cartridge. I'm like, dude, like, he's going to microdose it, which I don't understand how you microdose that because it is vaporized, but, you know, to each his own. But
Yeah, the way way Parsi described it, it was like ayahuasca is the mother, ibogaine's the father, and it kind of like strips everything away. And then when they did the 5-MeO and DMT, it kind of reprogrammed it, kind of like you were this blank slate, and it went back and recreated, is the way he described it. He actually went through the therapy just to test it. And I asked him, like, you know, how'd you go? And he's like, you know, he wasn't very descriptive. He was just like, yeah, it was intense. I was like waiting. I was like, I always imagine, I don't know what really, I mean, like, so earlier this, was it last year or 2 years ago, we did a podcast with the guys from Rhythmia, which is the place down in Costa Rica that does the ayahuasca thing. I think it's where Aaron Rodgers went. And they invited us to go. And I kind of reluctantly agreed to. And then my wife ended up getting diagnosed with breast cancer. And I ended up not going, which I think is kind of funny that her breast cancer probably saved me from going to do that. Just for the fact that those guys, my friends that went down there, there was a lot of vomiting. And I don't like to throw up. Like, I've never thrown up. Like, I don't like to throw up. Every time I throw up, I feel like I break a rib. So as soon as they were talking about, they're like, yeah, we couldn't stop throwing up, I was like, oh, thank God I didn't go.
Yeah, you're right about the vomiting part. Like, you know, they have you fast before you do any of these. But yeah, I began, like, I was, you know, dry heaving. I dry heaved about 4 times and very, very violently. It's like there was nothing in there, but you know, they kind of say it's like cleansing out all the bad energy. You're purging out bad energy. But and then my gray day, like, I couldn't eat anything during that time either. I had a quarter of a blueberry smoothie. And it was funny because I was sitting on a swing set on the side of the house that we were doing the treatment in, and the host was kind of out, like, consoling me because obviously it was a tough day for me. In the middle of the conversation, like, I just let loose of all that blueberry smoothie right in front of her. I'm like, is this normal? Does this happen a lot? And yeah, it was kind of embarrassing. But yeah, the way he kind of describes, like, the 5-MeO, that's one of those experiences where it's very hard to describe, and I describe it a lot to people the best I can, and that's probably only about 1% of the way, because, you know, it kind of is like we're living in the Matrix, and then that kind of shows you what reality really is when you go into that space, because the 5-MeO, it's only 15 to 20 minutes. So it's very short, but very intense, because, you know, they talk about ayahuasca DMT that lasts 4 hours maybe. And they say that's kind of like working your way up the mountain. 5-MeO, you go straight to the top of the mountain, and then you teleport to the heavens, essentially. It's a pretty crazy experience. And the one thing, when I went into it, because you smoke it, and, you know, it's kind of really surreal how you go into it, because so they have mattresses all over the ground, and you're sitting on those mattresses, you know, sitting upright. So you inhale for 10 seconds, and then you hold for 10 seconds, and they tell you to kind of ball up like you're about to do a cannonball, you know, tensing up all your muscles, so that when you release on the count of 10, you fall back and you're just in this relaxed state, and you're kind of just like in it, just like that. I had to do it twice because I didn't know what it was going to be like. And my first time, I didn't get there. And second time, there's no doubt that I achieved that, you know, what they call an ego death.
Mm, yeah.
Because you lose all sense of self, like your identity's gone, like, you know, they call it, it's basically a near-death experience for most people, because they talk about DMT being released in the brain twice in your lifetime.
Yeah.
Once when you're born and once when you die.
Sure.
So me, like, it was very uncomfortable in terms of not that I was seeing something crazy. I really didn't have visuals except for, like, when I first went into it. And it wasn't like I saw things. It was more kind of like, you know, there's like lots of prisms, like lots of things just kind of like coming together, I guess you could say, is kind of like all your senses are just becoming one. And that's kind of like the mending process.
Yeah.
But it was very uncomfortable because, you know, really wanted to have control. And when you're in that realm, you have no control. And, you know, the people there were really great. And, you know, they were like touching me on the hand, like telling me to remember to breathe and reminding me it was just the medicine. So I was just like, all right, like, I'm just going to let this happen. You know, I'm just going to let it take me to wherever it wants to take me. And when I did that, that's when I was able to kind of let the medicine really heal me in a way. It was a very spiritual experience for me because, I mean, you're laying there completely paralyzed because your body, your mind thinks that your body is dead and consciousness is just leaving the body, so you can't move at all. But, you know, a lot of spiritual things happen. Like, there was a point where it seemed like I was being exercised something really bad inside of me. And, you know, this purge was happening and it was the strongest, deepest, like my soul was being purged of like something bad. And it was pretty intense and very spiritual. And I have no doubt that for me, like, it was an encounter with God and it felt very holy, because when that happened, like, I shot up and it was just like something was being driven out to me. Because at that time I literally called on God, and that's when all this stuff started to happen. And after that purge, like, I fell back onto the mattresses. Light was just all around me. It was just like perfection. Like, it was just so pure, so holy. And to me, it felt like I was, there's just this comfort that overcame me. Like, I felt like I was in the arms of God, essentially. That's what it felt like. Like, I could just, something very spiritual about it. Like, just the feeling with my entire body. And there was this internal intuition about what was going on. Because, like I said, it's not so much what you see, it's what all your senses just becoming one. And I don't know, but it was just very pure. And, you know, kind of going into a biblical reference, you know, I think about a lot of things that happened during the 5-MeO. Like, they talk about the Bible, like, receiving the kingdom of God like a child. Like, that childlike surrender just happened to me. And, you know, they talk about a lot about inner child work, like, all my identity, all the cares of the world were stripped away. And, you know, it was just like that little kid inside of me that was just helpless. I felt like that was the part of me that was like calling out to God. It was the child inside of me. And that's why I was able to have that experience, because I was just able to let go and let whatever was going to happen, happen. And then I get to the perfect love, cast out all fear. Like, after I did the 5-MeO, my anxiety and fear and depression were just gone. Like, I was 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10, like, across the board on anxiety, depression, fear. Like, I was in a bad, bad spot. And after that, like, it was just like this cloud, this darkness was just removed from my life. Like, I had the clarity. It just felt like almost like that spiritual detox I was talking about. And all these doors were opened up into my mind. So it was no longer bound to be so rigid and narrow. But, you know, I question different things now that people say I'm not allowed to question. People, you know, I am able to, I just have this, all these ideas, all these different things that weren't once there. You know, I just feel like anything is possible now. Like, the possibilities with God are endless, and it's all good stuff. And, you know, I have this, you know, I feel like I've been given like a skill and a tool, like how to master my own mind. And, you know, it's been pretty cool, like, learning these different things and just being open-minded to all different teachings, really, because I feel like it all, at the end, like, we're all connected to God. And that this really kind of showed me to that, you know, different perspective on life after that experience.
So how do you balance this with football? You think about, like, the anger, the aggression, like, the violence. How do you kind of channel, like, what you've learned on this side to be able to kind of weaponize yourself on the other side and be able to do this you know, job?
Honestly, like, I just have so much more joy and energy now. Like, being out there, like, I feel like a little kid again, you know? Like, I have that joy, that excitement to go out there and just be competitive. And honestly, it's like I'm kind of giving a middle finger to my OCD every time I go out there and I'm like just doing what I was created to do. you know, I've been given these talents, and what a damn shame it would it be for me to not maximize those. And, all like the anger and the hate just comes from my towards my OCD, but now I can just kind of like laugh at it. Honestly, like I don't give away my energy freely anymore. Like I just do it because I just love playing football now. And it's not because I'm trying to do things for any other type of reason, except for just my enjoyment and my excitement. And, you know, it's just great just to be alive again, you know, be present. That's something I learned too, is just mindfulness and being in the present moment. Like I never realized how much before, like, you know, just getting stuck in thought, even if it wasn't like the OCD stuff, like just getting stuck in types of thoughts on stuff that just don't matter. Like I find myself a lot of times, I have this recognition that I'll play out these scenarios in my head, that these scenarios that go wrong, and I just start getting angry, like assuming the worst of people, assuming the worst of myself. I'm like, why do I do that? Why do I waste my energy on that? And getting lost in things like that, when I can just be present in the moment, be present in reality, because everything that we think in our minds, it's not even reality. It's not even real.
Yeah. What's the age old? Like we die 1,000 deaths before we ever die our real death.
Yeah. 100%. So it's just like, I'm just going to live in the present moment, and, you know, whatever happens, happens. Could be good, could be bad, but, you know, I'm going to live it right now versus anticipating it.
Yeah. Once you left it and left the facility, you said you went to, was it some like inpatient, outpatient type stuff or based on OCD?
Yeah, it was outpatient. So we went back to Alabama, which is where my wife's from and where we'll end up moving when I'm done playing football. But we have some land out there. It's just peaceful, just kind of nice. And, you know, it kind of gave me a chance to kind of recenter myself, block out all the noise, you know, get off social media, get away from all the noise, and just kind of like center back into myself. You know, it's kind of that self-exploration. And I was, you know, for 2 weeks, 3 hours a day, just hitting it hard. And, you know, it wasn't like immediate, like even to this day, I'm still kind of like learning new things. And, you know, each week has gotten better and better. It's kind of like one of those things, like you will kind of get immediate results, but it's like, you know, keep putting in the work like anything. I mean, you have to be very intentional every day, and there's no days off. Like if I want to have the quality of life that I have now in terms of like my mental health, like I have to be very intentional, diligent, the same way like I'm training my body to be ready on the field. Like I need to be able to train my mind and put these skills into practice, because like, you know, you take 2 weeks off and you're trying to play a game or something, it's not going to go so well. It's the same thing with your mind, and having that mind body connection, I realize how important it is, because one fails, the other fails. So just having that balance and that harmony between both has been really key. And I've even, you know, we've only been through OTAs, but I still just notice in my energy, and like, honestly, I think how I think really affects how I move and how everything in my body works together. And I've really noticed it, and, you know, I can feel those effects.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Well, it's got to be like a huge weight's been lifted off of you. I mean, the fact that you're fighting these like internal battles, this like damnation versus, I mean, like the internal monologue must have been so overwhelming that going out and like having to like, you know, process information and deal with that just probably felt very overwhelming. Like there was just a huge weight on you at all times. I mean, I can't imagine running up to line, going in there and like listening to calls, trying to do this and then deal with all this other stuff going on in the back of your head. I mean, the one thing I did really well was I was able to like clear my mind and like, you know, be 100% present in the moment. And like to the point where actually I looked forward to playing for the fact that I didn't have to think about anything else. And like all the cares of the world just kind of melted away. Everything got real quiet. The only sad part is then one day you don't get to play anymore, and it's really hard to find that again.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I just try to think about, you know, not being present in the moment. Just like I said, I was just kind of like in that sunken place. And, you know, last year, like, completely did not care about playing football, wasn't in it at all. Like, I remember, like, I would literally just watch film, like, maybe the night before. Like, I was just so out of it. Like, it was crazy, like, that I didn't get hurt majorly last year because I was not in tune. And remember at some point, because I got put on, you know, some antidepressants, like, a few games before, you, like, I got checked into that mental health facility, and I was on benzos. And I remember, like, taking, like, half a tablet of those before games just because, like, I had to, like, calm down my mind, and the anxiety was just so crazy. But I was essentially, it felt like I was drunk on the field sometimes, and that was really bad. And that's kind of like the point where it's like, all right, we need to do something about this, because can't be doing that. You got that intense. But yeah, just being able to have that presentfulness has been huge.
So now that you feel like you're like yourself, when you go out and you train and you kind of do everything, is it something where, like, you know, your wife and the people around you are have, like, noticed a massive change? I mean, obviously you're doing a lot of internal work. I just wonder, like, externally, the people that know you have observed, like, a massive change, like, or were you just really good at compartmentalizing and kind of hiding it?
Yeah. Like, when it was going on, like, it was so internal, like, all the compulsions were internal, but I mean, you could definitely see it on my face last year. I mean, my wife had firsthand, like, you know, I would always go for her for reassurance on certain things. Like, I'd be saying the same things over and over, having her reassure me. And it'd just be like these different things that come into my mind. But on the people on the outside, like, a lot of people just didn't know what was going on, because, I mean, how do you talk to anyone about these types of things? Like, they're not going to understand unless they are actually in your shoes.
Yeah.
And that was really hard, but luckily, you know, it was kind of a godsend. But last year, someone on our practice squad, you know, I started talking to him a little bit, and I found out he also had scrupulosity, and we started talking. So that was kind of like a little beam of light, you know, kind of hope at the end of the tunnel. And so that kind of kept me going, and it's kind of nice to have someone that kind of related to me on that aspect. And I was able to play off that a little bit. But other than that, like, it was just really tough because, again, like, no one truly understood. But I definitely think people see it now. I mean, one of the guys I do body work with, like, I've kind of talked to him about everything. He's kind of seen it from an outside perspective for a while, because I worked with him last year too, and working with him now. He says, like, stuff like, I'm faster to respond. Like, he doesn't feel any tension in my body compared to, like, last year. People have said, like, they can actually, like, see my eyes now versus, like, last year, you know, just kind of being in that, you know, that depressive state where it's like there's a body there, but there's no one behind those eyes.
Yeah.
And it's been 9 days with me and my wife. And, you know, when you're going through it, you're not grateful for the trial that you go through, but going through it now, like, on the other side of it, like, I'm honestly grateful that I had that experience. It wasn't easy. It wasn't fun, and got really dark during times, but I've become such a better man because of it. I have greater self-introspection, self-awareness, and it's shown me, I feel like we almost have to go through those dark times, because we're all going to go through dark times in our lives. And it's kind of like how you respond to it, because without that dark time, like, you have to see both in order to appreciate the other, because without the darkness, there is no light. So going through that, like, I appreciate things a lot more. I have a different perspective. Like, I got a whole lot of perspective in Colorado. Like, some of the stories I heard from people, like, you think our problems are bad, like, people got some serious stuff going on in their life, and it just shows you, man, like, you know, we're just here for a short time. Like, there's no point not loving one another and just like being in harmony with one another. We're all connected in one way or another, and like our problems are so much smaller compared to this whole world, you know?
Yeah, the interesting thing you brought up was about the DMT, you know, releasing twice. I kind of got stuck down, or not stuck, but I kind of went down that road a little bit, anticipation of going and doing this ayahuasca thing that I ended up not doing. But I read a book called The Immortality Key. We've talked about it on this podcast. And it really got into like some like early Christian mysticism and the fact that there was like a huge psychedelic component to Christianity early on. And the guy went and like looked at like, you know, the Temple of Eleusis, and there was definitely something within like the sacrament that was connecting people on some, you know, whether it be something psychedelic or whatnot. And so the way that the book came about was they did, I think it was at Duke University, they gave people kind of a heroic dose of psilocybin that were in stage 4 cancer. And then they interviewed them, and the people's acceptance of death and like, you know, the idea that we're connected, and a lot of the kind of the experiences these people gave while under the influence of psilocybin was like identical to the writings of the early Christian mystics. And that was the connection that this guy ended up writing this book about, The Immortality Key. And it was extremely helpful for me. I mean, just for the fact that, like, you know, when I would go to church as a kid and I would sit there, I would kind of like look around and be like, I don't really feel it. I don't really understand it. Like, how come, like I want to feel what these people are feeling? Like, I'd see, you know, people like it, you know, like, you know, feel that God was filling them in some way. And I kind of was like looking around and I'm like, I just don't get it. And so as I read that book, it made a lot of sense to me. I was like, oh, cause he said the exact same thing. Like I went to church as a kid, and you know, I've tried my entire life and it just never really connected on it. So I think, the experience that you went through probably would be beneficial for a lot of NFL players at the ending of their careers, for the fact that probably a lot of scrambling of the brain from using your head as a battering ram, a lot of the pressures of doing the job that most people don't realize, you know, like just being able to navigate it. And I think when you retire, all of a sudden, a lot of these, you know, things that people were able to kind of sweep under the rug or maybe deal with, you know, come to light. And a lot of guys have issues, and the way they deal with it is through drugs and alcohol and medication and, you know, porn and all these other, you know, fucking whatever else they get themselves into, and they use it as a coping mechanism. And I think what you went through is pretty interesting, for the mere fact that probably a lot of people could kind of benefit from this, kind of stripping away that death of you know, the ego death, and then realizing that, like, you know, we're here for a function, and the sooner we figure it out, the better we are. And I have to have something to live for, much more than just, you know, like you said, you know, posting on social media and fucking going to the next club.
Yeah, just kind of like you're talking about also with, like, you know, the TBI is like, this is so good for that. And there's a lot of teammates like I've talked to, and like, you don't even really need to wait until after you're done playing. Like, get on top of this now, because, you know, football, we're distracted in the moment. Like, there's so much going on, you don't have time to sit and think. And last year, I think it was having that time. My son was born. We weren't traveling around. I was injured. You know, I had that time to think, and that's when all these things start to come up. Like, my past was coming up. Like, you know, contemplating like the rest of my life. You know, thinking about, you know, thinking of God, taking my faith more seriously. Like, there's going to be things that come up for a lot of guys when they're done playing that they don't realize now. And my wife was always kind of like, things she was worried about when I got done playing, like how it was going to be. And, you know, everyone says this, it's like, oh, I'll be good. Like, I've got it figured out. But honestly, like, no matter how old you get, you really don't have it figured out.
Like, no, I was going to say, anybody that says that's full of shit. Like, if you figure like you got it figured out, like, unless you're, you know, Tony Gonzalez and you get to play 17 years and you get some, you know, spot on the sports desk. And then I see Tony standing up next to Bezos at his wedding. So, I mean, there's very few people that like get that type of storybook deal. But I think for a lot of guys, because like, whether it be the TBIs or maybe they're just maybe missing, well, I think it's twofold. I think when you're a high-level athlete at a young age, a lot of people will make exceptions for you, and they will not hold you to the standard at which they should other hold other people. So because you're a high level athlete and you're good and this, like, people will kind of help you along. You know, maybe your grades aren't as good, or maybe you have some behavioral issues, or like, they're able to kind of couch you and be like, oh, he's a great athlete. And you'll kind of get this like preferential treatment through life. And then you get to the NFL and, you know, let's say you're an incomplete person and you don't know, you know, basic social graces on, like, you know, if somebody calls you to, like, you know, return a phone call, which, or just how to treat people. And I think people make a lot of excuses because you're a professional athlete and you play at a high level, and they realize, like, oh, this guy's so good, he's probably deficient. And then you retire and realize that that excuse doesn't work anymore, that you have to be a real person. You can't be a fucking cartoon character. And I think that's something I've noticed with a lot of, like, my former teammates who were kind of incomplete humans once they retired. Like, people stopped making exceptions for them. They stopped being like, oh, it's okay, we'll sweep it under the rug. And so I think something like what you went through, whether it be, you know, Ibogaine's pretty intense, you know, psilocybin, or let's say you want to go do ayahuasca or something. I mean, something that allows you to kind of view yourself from the outside. I think that's what's so powerful about it, is you get to kind of like step away almost out of your own body and view yourself, which I think is extremely helpful. For if you can view yourself on how other people view you, that's a great indicator for, you know, helping you become a better version of yourself.
100%. I mean, kind of that lifting of the veil, because, I mean, you take a step back from all of it, like you said, like, you know, everyone's kind of putting athletes on a pedestal. And, you know, I think the platform is great because, you know, when these types of things happen, like, you know, we can help people, but a lot of time that platform is not used well. And I didn't use it well for my first 7 years, really. I mean, not that I abused it, but I mean, I could have definitely used it for a lot better things. But yeah, it's just like one of those things I feel like everyone really needs, whether you're an athlete or not, is to be able to kind of see things for what they are, because the busyness of life, like, you're not going to be able to truly see that until you, like, take a step back and, you know, you just think about I guess you think about all the hippies in, like, the 70s. Maybe they had it right, you know, all of them were just happy and, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, maybe people figured it out. I mean, I you know, as advanced as we think we are, you know, and this is something I wrestle with all the time. You know, I'm older than you, so I'm from a, like, kind of an interesting generational kind of piece, in that I remember what it was like to not have computers, not have cell phones, you know, like, something, you know, I got three kids, and something I was talking to my daughters about, I'm like, you guys have zero phone etiquette. We had a phone, we had one phone in the house, it rang and you had to, like, answer it and be like, hello, Wellborn residents, and, like, write down messages, or my parents would get pissed because we didn't have an answering machine. And, like, you know, so I'll call them on the phone and they'll, like, won't even say anything. They'll be like, hello. I'm like, you guys have the worst phone etiquette. And I realized they've never had to really have phone etiquette. So, you know, and then you think about, you know, information, like having to read. I mean, like, I was telling them, and I think this is really funny that I relive this stuff to my kids, but talking to them about being in college and having to write papers and do research by actually going to the library and reading books and, like, you know, Dewey Decimal System and microfiche and pulling stuff out and reading it, not having the entirety of the world at your fingertips with a computer, with Google, and now with AI. I mean, like, the with all of this, like, you almost had to be, like, a little bit of, like, an Indiana Jones type of person to find information. And, you know, you had to go talk to people, and, like, it was just, I mean, even when I wanted to start lifting weights, you know, I was calling people on the phone and ended up going and training with this old power lifter and trying to, like, call people on the phone because people didn't have emails. There was no social media. I mean, just the fact that, with social media now, watching a lot of guys training, if I had known to the extent at which other people were doing stuff, I would have gone and visited them. It was something I was telling Fries. I was like, dude, if I knew that there was dudes that were this strong or these doing something, I would have gone and visited them, just for the fact that I thought I was doing all this stuff in a silo. I thought nobody was training as hard as we were. And now that I know that there's other people out there doing cool shit, I probably would have gone and investigated them more. But I also think that being self-sufficient and being able to find this information and being able to do this work is you know, therapeutic or cathartic or whatever you want to say, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's kind of like that age of convenience. Like, you know, there's pros and cons to it for sure. And you know, I think it's up to us, obviously, to maximize the pros and try to minimize the cons. I mean, like you're talking about, like social media, like it's a great tool for like resources and finding out information, but also like, you know, maybe I could get distracted with the wrong things. You know, that's also a cesspool of a lot of stuff that just isn't beneficial for me, doesn't fill me with the right stuff. Like, you know, we don't always just, it's not just always consuming with what we eat, but like, you know, consuming with what we hear, consuming with what we see, you know, it's not always good for us as human beings for in different aspects, like to consume that type of stuff. And
it's kind of like, I'm pretty sure you don't read the local sports writers in Indy. Like I unfortunately one time, read something and I remember being like, God, like this is how these people view us, and had like kind of an existential moment where like I realized, I was like, God, this is like, what do these people think we're doing? You know? And, you know, like the weird feeling that they cast on us that like, these guys don't really want to play. They don't want to be here. I'm like, fuck dude, everybody gets paid. We're out there trying to kill ourselves. And then realizing some like middle-aged fat dude who's basically hiding in his mom's basement's writing this shit, who's never strapped it up a single day and is just doing it for, you know, to try to create some form of controversy. That was an interesting realization that like, not everybody's writing this stuff and for accuracy. They're writing it for, you know, and this is the stuff we get into social media with rage bait. You know, people are saying things, they're doing things just to create rage, which creates, you know, controversy, which just creates this like critical mass of craziness. And like, you know, you look at like what's happening in the political climate and, you know, I mean, you know, shit, we're bombing Iran, we're not bombing Iran. I mean, it's like, it's almost overwhelming to the point where if you got other stuff going, it's really easy to get stuck in this stuff and spin out instead of stepping back and realizing like most of all of this is bullshit and doesn't affect me in a single day. But yet people get so wrapped up in it, like they're somehow, this is going to affect their day-to-day life.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, for me, you know, I stopped using social media. I turned it back on recently because obviously trying to answer some messages, but like once that article came out, like, you know, there's people that kind of come out and talk about, you know, asking about the Ibogaine, asking about like what kind of things helped you. But before that, like I found myself kind of on a binge on a lot of political stuff, and I was just getting angry for no reason. Like it was everywhere, and obviously the algorithm would keep popping up more stuff and keep feeling that rage. And it's just like, you know, I didn't really realize until like a year later, like it was creating so much like violence in my head. Like I was thinking about all these terrible things I'm going to do to like the other side or all these terrible people. It's just like a false reality that I was living in my head. You know, those false perceptions. It's like you said, like this stuff affects me, but I'm letting it affect me by getting angry or, you know, any other type of negative emotion with these things. And I can just tune it out. It's just up to me to do it and you know, focus on what matters, be present in the moment.
Yeah, like being a good father, being a good husband, going out and fucking brutalizing people in the football field, which I loved. Like the simplicity of football was amazing. And I don't think that you realize it until you don't play anymore. And I think you got a glimpse of it for the fact that you were going through this and you kind of had to step away from the game. And it's almost as if now you're getting this kind of reboot in a lot of ways where, you know, you're talking about the joy and the, you know, that, you know, the excitement to go out and play. I'm jealous. It's exciting. And, I think there's so much stigmatism attached with these treatments. I mean, the fact that you had to go to Mexico to get this done, you know, like you think about, you know, I mean, where I live here in Austin, it's very, like you said, very hippie. There's like all these different, like, we had a guy on the podcast that had like a church up the road where he was doing, I think it was like, Jacob, what did that guy do? Was it like Ibogaine? Oh yeah. It was, yeah. Okay. He was taking people on these like, psilocybin mushroom adventures, to try to like heal their PTSD. And he had like some like Church of Light up the road. He came on the podcast. So it's always fascinating to see how people are dealing with this stuff. And, I think the problem that we run into in this country is that we're just trying to, you know, kind of manage everything through better pharmacology. Oh, like, you know, what you're going through, is some chemical imbalance in your brain that if we give you just the right mixture of this and this and this, it'll cool it off. And like, I don't think that works in any way. I think all it does is create more and more problems. So, I mean, I'm a much bigger fan of something like you did, which might sound extreme, but sounds way less extreme than taking benzodiazepine every single day and feeling like you're drunk out on the football field.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just kind of like one of those things. You think about pharmaceuticals, and very much all it does is disassociate. You know, you get all these terrible side effects. Like, you're dependent on it. If you skip one day, like, things could completely fall off the rails. You know, you have to build up, and they eventually have to take more and more. And what happens when that stops working? And you're onto something stronger, something a little more potent. And it's just a slippery slope, and you know that leads to drinking. You know, you're mixing different combinations, and it's just bad. But you think about psychedelics, that heightens everything. It gets the brain working more in unison. You know, heightens all your senses. You know, corrects things, and you know. Talk about neuroplasticity of the brain. You know, you're able to make changes in your life without, you know, I talk about, like, you know, how the Ibogaine, like, opened up my mind. Like, it literally did. Like, I was no longer rigid inside my actual brain. Like, my brain was, like, flexible now. Like, I actually had the ability to think outside the box, per se. But yeah, I mean, obviously not people, but, you know, Big Pharma doesn't want people to know about this. Like, it costs $7,000 for the entire treatment. And, like, I've had this much results. Going to Colorado was...
I was going to say that sounds cheap. I was like, seven grand sounds way cheap. The fact that you didn't have to go, like, you just did this one treatment and you did it. I mean, that's feels like pretty money well spent. Whereas, you know, if it was pharmaceuticals, you'd be about 2 weeks in, about $7,000.
Yeah, and you spent years and years and years. Like, this is 5 days, and obviously, it's up to you to put in the work afterwards, but it's not like I'm taking Ibogaine and DMT every morning. Like, I don't have to do that, but I do microdose psilocybin, but I've actually, and it's really easy because honestly, the company that I use, like, they send me grow bags, and they're out of Colorado grow bags. I had four of them, $100 in total for the entire kit. And I grew my own, and I got over 600 microdoses made by myself for $100. And that's a 2 year, maybe 3 year supply. And that's something that, you know, I just do on and off, like, helps me continue to have, like, clarity, you know, just take it on different days, but it's been great for my overall mood and health. And it's been really beneficial. And, you know, just doing things like that, like, people have the ability to do these things for themselves, grow things that are natural. And, you know, I don't have any bad side effects. Like, when I was microdose, like, I have clarity. Like, I have, like, this boost of energy, more in tune, more focused. Like, it's just like laser focus. So if I get, like, let's say I'm writing a paper or something like that, like, I can just be focused on that paper, be disconnected from all the outside noise, and just hone in on what I want to hone in on, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, Big Pharma obviously does not want things like this. You can't put a patent on Ibogaine's a tree root. 5-MeO, they use a synthetic version, but, you know, in its natural form, it's a toad venom.
Like, how does the NFL view this? I mean, I know the NFL's super cunty on all this stuff. I mean, the fact that, and I probably got myself into more trouble than it was worth with the NFL for the mere fact that I remember asking them, like, okay, why are these set of drugs okay and these aren't? Like, why is it that I can go in and get a Toradol shot and this and this and this, and you guys prescribe all these things, but yet, like, you know, I was never a marijuana smoker. Like, I'm not a cannabis guy by any means. But I had a lot of teammates that smoked fucking more pot than a reggae band. And, you know, that to me felt like a better solution than just, you know, going out and handing out, you know, painkillers like breath mints. And, you know, early in my NFL career, you're going to laugh at this, when on away games, when you get on the plane, they used to give out beers. So you'd go on, you'd get, like, your lunch, and they give you two beers. And then you'd sit down, and then the trainer would come by with, like, a box full of painkillers, and they would kind of shake them, and they sounded like, we used to call them rattlers because they sound like a rattlesnake. And they'd be like, hey, you need this? And they would just kind of hand them out to guys. And so, like, there was this weird trade where guys would be like, hey, I'll trade you beer for those painkillers. And so we'd have this, like, I'd end up with, like, four or five beers, and then somebody else would get some other stuff. And then some coaches got drunk and got into a fight on the plane, and then they took the beer away. And then, you know, Junior Seau killed himself and guys started killing themselves and they started taking all the painkillers away. So I think that things were real fast and loose. And I think because they were fast and loose, they probably had to make some changes. But I mean, I would much rather see some guys, like if they're dealing with that form of level chronic pain, I would much rather see them take, you know, something like a, you know, cannabis based product than, you know, the opioid based stuff. I mean, the fact that I played with a lot of guys that were severely addicted to opiates. And I think those guys today have the most amount of problems.
Yeah, I think everyone's just really looking, you know, for the short term solution. What's going to get someone feeling better fast? I think it's important to like look at long term, like how's this going to affect long term health? Because obviously, like, you know, taking these like painkillers and, you know, alcohol, like, you're not just going to become suicidal overnight, but over time, like, you know, the chemical imbalances in your brain start to form, your way of thinking starts to change, and that's a slow, slow death versus like something like psychedelics. Like, you know, it's taboo right now, but luckily they do have like studies going on in Texas, which is really cool to see. And I hope that it becomes, you know, legal hopefully soon in however many years. But yeah, I don't think I haven't got any backlash on it yet, although I did get a random drug test right after that article came out with me talking about doing the Ibogaine, the 5-MeO random drug test.
Was it a steroid one or the street drug test?
I think it was a steroid, but still, it's just kind of like, surely enough, like random drug test, who knows?
Yeah, they do that. I think it was, what was his name? The guy that played for the Browns, a defensive lineman. Was it Miles? I'm going to fuck his name up. Miles Garrett. Yeah, Miles Garrett, like, posted that shirtless picture, and then they hit him with like three back-to-back drug tests. He was like, God, I've been drug tested 3 weeks in a row. I was like, well, look at you, dude. You're like 285, 290 looking jacked like that. Of course they're going to come for you. Like, yeah. Like, what'd you think was going to happen?
Yeah, 100%. So, I mean, I get it. But, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if, you know, the NFL's like being serious about like safety, which, you know, it can be questionable at times.
Yeah. And they forced you guys to take a vaccine for something that was a respiratory issue. I mean, that was completely unvetted. I mean, and then forced you guys to take it and then didn't say anything and have never come out and been like, yeah, we totally violated all your rights and we forced you to take an experimental drug. Like, I that blew my mind.
Yeah, that was pretty wild. And, you know, Indianapolis is actually one of the least vaccinated teams at the time. And, you know, I remember when in the thick of it, I think it was my fourth year, they'd always have these two guys from the league and they were just patrolling around. You knew exactly who they were because they never left each other's side. I got slapped with some fines, like literally not wearing a mask into the shower. Like, what are we doing? Like,
yeah,
you know, get out there, you can practice, you can breathe on people, but then things off the field become contagious. Like, it doesn't really make any sense. And honestly, like, even now I think about like the safety stuff, like with helmets, like I've tried. So my helmet was in the red this year. I've been wearing it for 7 years, never had a concussion. And this year I had to get a new helmet.
Why? So
I
got one. What was wrong with the helmet? Too heavy?
It didn't pass testing, whatever that means. Which, I mean, you can't sell helmets if things that are safe stay safe too long. So you got to make something that's safe. So I got stuck in, I got put in one of the top three helmets. And I got a concussion during OTAs. The guy accidentally hit me in the head, like while I was holding it back for him. I'm like, what are we doing here?
What was different about the helmet? Was it because it was lighter, heavier, smaller?
It was like one of those helmets that has like those memory foams, and it was a shut helmet. And basically, I got hit in the helmet. It's kind of like one of those helmets, outer shell, that's like really flexible and it's supposed to absorb the force, but instead of the force going absorbed from the helmet and dispersing out, it dispersed right into the center of my head. And that's the first time I was like, this is definitely a concussion. I've got my bell rung before, you know, doing 10 seconds, but this one is like lingering for a couple weeks.
So you're going to laugh. Just, when I came in the NFL, they told us that you'd know you got a concussion when you got knocked unconscious, which was hilarious because I remember like, how am I going to know I got a concussion if I get knocked unconscious? I'm going to be unconscious. It's like, oh, when you wake up from being knocked unconscious, that's how you know you get a concussion. And I was like, oh, okay. So then like 10 years later, they gave that same talk. You know you got a concussion when anytime you hit, you feel any form of disorientation, you know, your eyes lose focus, you hear ringing in your ears, any form of like disorder, like losing orientation, that's a concussion. And I was like, wow, in 10 years, you went from me getting knocked unconscious. So then I remember they asked, they were like, you know, early on, they were like, hey, you ever got a concussion? I'm like, I've never been knocked out. And then at the end, after that definition, you're like, I don't know, 70,000 of these things. Like every single play of my NFL career, probably come back into the, you know, walking back to the huddle, feeling cross-eyed. Like, okay, that's a concussion now.
Yeah, it's just weird every year. Like everything changes, but. You know, I'm in a big battle just to get my helmet back right now. I know there's been some other guys that have been complaining, but it's like, it should be a personal decision. Like, obviously, I know what's safe for me. And, you know, everyone knows themselves better. I don't think anyone wants to play in something that they're actually going to get hurt in. I don't think anyone wants to take anything that's actually going to be detrimental to their health. Like, I think we're all trying to do what's best for our health and, you know, it's kind of crazy to think that, you know, you're going to have someone else saying, hey, I know what's best for you. Like, no, you don't. You don't know what's best for me.
Especially somebody's never played the game.
Yeah, I trust my wife to know what's good for me. Like, the people that love me and want me around for a long time, I trust them more than, once I'm out of the league, are you going to care about my health anymore? No. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care at all.
Just know 5 years after you retire, so they'll give you life, or they'll give you medical benefits for 5 years, and after that 5 years, you're on your own. Which is funny because we have to buy insurance every year, and every year it seems to go up and up and up. It's ridiculous, and I'm always like, man, like that was one of my kind of gripes for the NFL, especially with the PA. I'm like, even if you don't want to give me like lifetime, you know, because if you in baseball, if you play one play in the majors, you get lifetime medical benefits.
Which I think is crazy. You think about the contract stuff too. Like, you know, every other sport is fully guaranteed contract, you know, health benefits. Like, you know, there's definitely a change that needs to be made. I don't know how that goes about, but I mean, especially with like the intensity of like football in terms of injuries, like, I don't know how many concussions you can get playing like NBA or baseball, you know? Like,
well, I think honestly, the way the owners work, that I think they secretly hope that we all just fall into a hole after you retire. And they're like, oh, like, just flush those guys, like send them off to the island of misfit toys. So, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, every year we go through this with insurance, like trying to get, you know, buy into these different plans and this. And the reason I'm griping about it is I'm going through it right now. But yeah, I mean, it would be nice if like the NFL had something where I could just call up and buy it from them, at least get in on like, you know, whatever the NFL insurance was, I think with Cigna. But yeah, it's an interesting piece. So on a positive note, what's the expectation going into the season? I mean, you know, you got any goals, anything you want to do, anything you're really looking forward to, or just merely just going out there and having fun again?
Honestly, I really just think it's just having fun again. I mean, I think everything just kind of falls in place. Like, obviously, you don't have goals and stuff like that, but I'm just getting better every day. But, you know, it's kind of like I can use my obsessive mind for positive now versus like, you know, a negative, like, you know, focusing on the wrong things. But now I can focus back on being obsessive over my craft and, you know, just getting better every day. But, you know, just going out there, having fun. And, you know, I think one of the things I'll miss when I'm done playing is just like the locker room and being around the guys. And, you know, last year I missed out on that. I wasn't really around the guys because I was locked up in my own head. So I'm just excited just to go out there and play. And at the end of the day, like, I'm going to be the best version of myself that I can be. And whatever happens, happens. And honestly, I don't care what anyone's opinion of how I play is. I mean, I see past that. It's just kind of like, whatever. Everyone's going to have an opinion. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I got to look myself in the mirror and, you know that I gave it all that I had. And I just want to be completely free, and I think this experience from last year has allowed me to be free and just enjoy it, because at the end of the day, it's a child's game. no one's going to remember me. And probably even after I play, like a year after, they'll be like, who's that Braden kid? You know, like no one's going to remember any of that. So
I don't believe that. Don't believe that at all. You are fucking delusional if you think that. Like I retired in 2009 and I still had people roll up to me and I still had people like shoot me things. Like I just had some guy tag me in some like something from the Eagles. Like it's pretty interesting. I kind of thought the same thing. I'm like, after I retire, nobody will ever remember this stuff. But it'll be weird that like all of a sudden in the mail, I'll get like some guy randomly. I don't even know how these people get my address. I'll get like a trading card. Hey, can you sign this? And like, I showed it to my kids and my daughter's like, can I have that? I'm like, no, I'm going to sign it and send it back to this guy. She's like, he'll never know. I'm like, yeah, but like this dude went through a lot like to get him this. And the fact that he has it, like I'm happy to send it back to him. So I think when you're doing it, it feels like very internal, like I'm doing this. And when you get done, you realize that it like impacts a lot of people that like not in, in a way that you and I could never imagine. But I definitely agree with you. The fun part of playing football, especially at the level you, which you do, is actually the offensive line and the group and the people you're playing with and like the camaraderie and the shit talking. It's the best, you know, to the point where like when you do retire, you're going to have to find something to kind of fill that void a little bit. I mean, I'm very fortunate. I train some of the top jiu-jitsu players in the world and I train with those guys. And we have a kind of a very similar relationship to what I had in terms of playing offensive line. And it's added something to my life I didn't know I was missing.
No doubt. I mean, that's definitely something I'm going to miss, but luckily I do have a kind of a plan going out of it. You know, me and my wife, we're gonna homestead in Alabama. We kind of put in a little tiny stack of some apple trees and peach and pear trees and a little plot of land in Alabama. So we're gonna start the orchard. But yeah, I'll be busy full scaling it over there and just kind of using the talents that God gave me in terms of agriculture. You know, just give back a little bit. But that's something I'm excited about.
How much land?
Definitely don't. Say again.
How much land?
It's her grandfather's land and it's enough land that I don't know how much it is.
Oh,
but
it's a lot.
The grandfather and her dad, they love that land. And I think they're just excited that, you know, I have interest in the land and I want to upkeep it and, you know, do some, really cool things with it. And, you know, they've been really supportive with that. And, you know, the grandpa's the one that kind of, gets excited about something, like he goes all in and, you know, he's been helping out, get a lot of things to help, like, plant the seeds and stuff like that. And he just, yeah, they've been really great about that. And it's exciting to make those memories with our family. It was kind of cool. This past year, we're putting in some trees. And, you know, I got a 17-month-old son at home. And we have the whole family's out there planting the trees. And we have him stick one in a hole. And he was only about probably like 13 or 14 months at the time. So it was really, really kind of cool to see just everyone kind of coming together around that type of thing.
Man, that, I think it's a pretty good plan. I have land out here in Texas and I have a massive creek that we've been excavating. And some days I really enjoy it. And other days I want to burn it to the ground and go move to a place with no yard. So it's a love-hate relationship, but Texas is also like one of the most inhospitable places I've ever lived. It's like, it's hot, it's miserable. Like this time of year it's a nightmare, but it sounds pretty dope, dude. Well, dude, hey man, I appreciate you coming on the podcast and like sharing the story. I know it's probably not easy or, you know, not fun to relive it, but I definitely appreciate you taking the time to come on and I'm excited to see you play this year. And even though I'm not a huge Colts fan, I'm going to root for you just for the fact that I think it's an incredible story and I'm so glad you made it out the other side.
Yeah. I appreciate you having me on. And, you know, I think just having a story like this, I think it's my duty to kind of tell it, you know, give some hope for other people. I mean, obviously like when you're going through it, you don't feel like you're ever going to come out the other side, but you know, there's definitely people that come out the other side. And when I was going through it, like, you know, I didn't seem like it was, but you know, I'm just grateful to be able to tell the story. And yeah, cool. Just thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell it.
All right, man. Well, best of luck. Thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See you.